All right, thanks for joining us today on the CoachCast podcast. Today we're joined by guest Jeff Moyer of DC Sports Training. All right, Jeff, thanks for joining us today, buddy. Really appreciate you coming on the show. This one I'm super excited for.
Thank you, boys. It's an honor. Thank you very much for taking the time out of your day, especially your day off to chat with me, man.
Absolutely. So just for those people that maybe haven't heard you or not sure kind of what you do in the world, do you mind just giving them a bit of a background on yourself and kind of what you've been busy with?
Sure. I own my own facility here in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I've been here for about 8 years. I work with clients from 7 to 70 years old, middle school, high school, college, all levels, professional athletes. I do consulting work, and yeah, it's a mixed bag of what we do. Kind of depends on what is needed to be done, I guess.
Yeah, and I've actually been, so just for the guests, that I've been a bit of a fan of yours for, I think, the last few years, just following your kind of information on social media, Strength Coach Network. I know you're at the CVAS conference and things like that. I think that could have been where I originally came across kind of your work, and even with Graham Morris down under, just kind of just speaking to that dude.
Big Graham. Yeah.
Big Graham. So yeah, so I, like I said, I'm excited to get into this one. I know Ash is gonna kick us off with the first question.
Yeah, perfect. So yeah, but again, thanks, Jeff, for coming on. I think one of the things that you seem to make it a bit of a dent in the S&C world at the minute is with your vision and perception training. And I'd love to be able to get into that today and almost understand why is it important in the first place to understand vision and perception, and what's the difference between them?
Sure, man. So for me, I'm a movement guy. That's kind of, if I have to give a quick little synopsis of what I do with my athletes, right? Sports is about movement. It's the art of movement. My job is get my athletes better at movement. And our visual system, you know, contributes, I don't know, I've seen anywhere from 70 to 90% of the information to our perception and decision making. And if I'm trying to get my athletes better at moving, well, I want to, you know, I want to exhaust everything I can to get them better at moving. And I don't want to forget about the driver behind the car, so to speak. Quick little story. We were talking a little bit beforehand, you know, that kind of got me down this is, you know, my background's more or less, apprenticing under Dr. Yeses for 10 years. Dr. Yeses has a PhD in biomechanics. So usually when I get an athlete, the first thing I look at is I want to look at their movements. And working in tennis when I first moved here, there's this pretty good tennis athlete that was, you know, kind of mid-level for his age, you know, around, it was 16 years old, wasn't anything fantastic. Really great kid, really hardworking, but his backhand was kind of the crutch of his game. People just kept hitting shots to his backhand, and he just couldn't get the shot or get to it or whatever. And so we would break it down, we'd biomechanics the shit out of it, we'd specialize exercise that we, you know, from a motor learning standpoint, you know, from went from closed to open and all that stuff. And it got better. It did get better, but it still had its weak points. And so a friend of mine named Ryan Harrison, who owns a company, Slow the Game Down, he was a visual scout for a professional baseball team at the time, and he was in the Pittsburgh area scouting some players. And he came to my facility one day and said, hey kid, you know, come over, you know, come over here. And he didn't know anything about this kid. And he did a quick 2 second little visual assessment on the kid. And then I came over and I said, what's going on? He goes, I bet you he struggles with off speed shots to his backhand because he's always mechanically pulling it. He's always out in front. I said, well, how the hell did you know that? And he goes, because his right eye sees things closer and is about 20%, I don't know how he came up with the number, he said about 20-30% weaker than his left eye. Well, the right eye, because he's a right-handed player, is his eye closest to the ball for his backhand. And if it perceives it closer, he's going to be out, you know, he's going to have a tendency to jump the ball, tend to be out in front. So his perception is what was thrown off his mechanics. I was like, well, holy shit. You know, I'm a movement guy. I didn't know that. And, you know, that to me is kind of what blew open the door for wanting to look at how perception affects movement. And then really getting into, I love talking motor learning. I love motor learning, motor control. I have a deep passion for that. And, you know, really deep diving down into ecological psychology, dynamical systems theory, constraints led approach, all that stuff, and how our movements, you know, our movements lead to our actions, and our actions lead to our perception, or our perception leads to our actions, actions lead to our perception. It's a circle, it's a cycle. But our perception of the environment is what's going to dictate what we do. Your movements on the pitch, on the court, are going to dictate my movements on the pitch, on the court. And, you know, how fast you can perceive and react, or where you get your eyes to, how fast you can shift your focus back and forth, how well you can perceive, you know, peripherally, or track things peripherally, and all that stuff plays into it, is going to lead to your decision-making and your process. So, for me, vision is a part of perception. You know, knowledge of the situation is also going to lead to perception, sound and feeling and all that stuff, all the sensory stuff that goes into it leads into perception. And so that's kind of what kicked it off for me, man. And so for me, you know, yes, I still look at the biomechanics of what an athlete has to do, their forehands, their backhands, their serves, but then I want to do a bunch of visual things. I want to understand how they perceive things, because that's going to lead to some of their mechanical things. That's going to lead to, you know, stuff like that. And again, if I'm trying to get them better at movement, well, I want to try to look at everything, not just how the car runs, but I want to see how the driver perceives the environment, and go from there. Hopefully that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. And I got to say, I love that analogy about the car, because on where else I've heard it as well, you talk about how the shell of the car, the engine and stuff, that's like their speed, their strength, and all this kind of things. And then you said, well, I actually care about the driver as well. And it kind of clicked. I was like, actually, there's something else behind all the muscles and stuff that actually has to put the car where it needs to go, has to put the feet where they need to go. So that actually made like a huge difference to how at least I started to think about, okay, maybe I'm missing a trick here by not knowing anything about it. So if we know that it's important now, we want to understand it, is there any way you can go to almost assess somebody's ability at this thing, almost like maybe what that coach was almost starting to see or starting to think about when he came to have a look at your tennis athlete?
Yeah, so Dr. Bill Harrison, the late Dr. Bill Harrison at the time, was a mentor of mine. His son Ryan, who runs the company now and does all the vision training out in Laguna Beach, California, he's been a great resource to me. I would check out anything those guys have. They have, they got some books, they got all types of equipment and stuff like that. They have a course, that's really knowledgeable. It's not too like over the top knowledgeable for those who don't have a background in neurology and stuff like that. Does give some background as far as, you know, what part of the eye, what part of the brain and this stuff, but it's not too heavy. It's more practical than it is heavy in the science stuff, which for me, that's kind of what I want, more of the practical stuff first. Kind of go from there. I mean, the great book that I constantly refer people to is The Quiet Eye Technique by Dr. Joan Vickers. She's got some YouTube videos, or there are some YouTube videos out there on the Quiet Eye Technique, going over what it is and stuff. But her book really kind of gives the deep science behind what Slow the Game Down teaches, what Ryan is teaching. As far as that, a lot of that's such a weird industry in my opinion, because it's led by a lot of optometrists. There's a couple of different camps. There's one camp it's kind of led by optometrists who have obviously deep knowledge of the eyes and vision and stuff like that, way more than I'll ever know or understand. But it's also limited to generalities, as far as that's not, you know, they don't go as far as how the eyes are used in sport and stuff like that. And then you got kind of like now the motor learning camp of, you know, the ecological psychologists and dynamical system theory and stuff like that. That's all about perception, but doesn't necessarily understand the visual side of it. They talk the perception and how to constrain the environment, the organism, or the task. But, you know, not if there's a problem in the visual system, how that's going to affect their perception of the environment, the organism, or the task. And so combining those. So right, in my opinion, it's kind of like you got to kind of study the both of them, and then kind of figure it out a little bit. But I would really implore, first and foremost, everyone go to Slow the Game Down, and check out their stuff. Their course is awesome. They got really cheap and great pieces of equipment that you can use with low level and high level stuff. Their information on social media is great, and they're working with high level athletes. They work with professional baseball players for, I don't know, 40, 50 years. They got professional football players out there doing stuff. It's pretty awesome.
That's really interesting. It almost sounds like you talk about the two different camps, and a lot with most things, the answer is probably somewhere in the middle. So yes. Maybe if there was a way that a coach could at least understand, okay, I probably need to speak to the head coach or the athlete's main coach to see what they believe their perception's like, because they'll understand their game-based movements. And then almost having either somebody else you can speak to or having the knowledge of yourself about the vision and that kind of eye movement and the quiet eye type of thing, maybe that's another space to have a look to. At least like if you're trying to make a really holistic big picture about an athlete, that's something you've also got to think about.
For sure. And, you know, and again, that's the argument. There's a really great conference here in the United States put on by Sean Mishka, movement. It's all about motor learning. I forgot the name of the conference. Jesus, I spoke at it 2019 up in Minnesota. And he's done it also, I think, virtually online with people from across the pond. But it's great. It's all about motor learning. And I think that's very rare. And I think it's awesome. And the majority of the people that present on that are really heavy in the constraints-led approach, the ecological psychology approach. Perception leads to action and vice versa. Your action leads to then your perception and how we should kind of more self-organize and this and that. But the question I always have is, what if they have a problem in their visual system? What if they have a perceptual issue? You know what I mean? And the cool, I mean, it's not cool, but it's been cool since I've kind of started talking about this more and I presented at CVAS. A lot of people don't know they have a visual issue until it's brought to their attention. So for instance, there was, after I presented at University of Richmond a couple of years ago, a major Division I basketball coach here for a national championship team that year, the team that won the national championship, oddly enough, reached out to me and wanted to do like a Zoom call with him and his staff and go over some stuff. And I was like, sure, absolutely. So we jumped on a Zoom call and I gave him this very same test that Ryan gave to that athlete of mine. That's the first thing I did with him. And he had a visual issue and he didn't even know it. And I was like, that's exactly my point. Like, people don't know they have these perceptual issues because they've lived with it for so long. So I've had athletes, I've had Division II girls basketball player. We were doing something once and she got double vision. And I said, hon, does that happen a lot? She goes, well, not when I think about it. I was like, wait a second. So you have to think about not seeing double? She goes, yeah. I said, does that happen like with school and stuff? She goes, yeah. I was like, have you said that to anyone? She said, no, I just thought that was normal. And I've had multiple people like this. So this is not just a one-off. Like again, most people don't know they have a visual issue until it's brought to their attention. That's why I implore people. So here in the States, I don't know how it works for you boys. Our athletes have to get physicals every year, which I think is fine and great and everything. But I also think they should have a visual assessment every year done by a professional. A lot of the visual assessments here that are done are by school nurses in freaking schools that they have no background in this shit. They're just making sure that they don't have cancer of the eye or something. So I don't know. It's been really interesting. Most people don't know they have an issue. And I implore anyone to go see a specialist, check it out.
I think that's really interesting. Only, I don't know, Chris, unless you got a question, but I'll just like summarize this up because there's something Dan John said in one of his books. It was like one of the first things he does before he takes a client is like, you have to go see a doctor first and an eye doctor as well. Because they can see, major issues with the eye and cancer, I think, or other big issues. So maybe if we're not sure where to look as coaches at the minute, we should just say, okay, well, you need to at least go and see an eye doctor first. Yep. And in case there's anything there that we're not aware about. And then it's outsourcing our knowledge because we might not know very much, especially as like a young coach. So outsource that to somebody who can. So you've got the eye doctor on one side, head coach is the actual perception side on the other side. And then hopefully you can meet in the middle and talk between both sides.
For sure. Absolutely.
Do you send a lot of your guys or girls to the eye doctor straight away?
So I've been fortunate to have learned a good bit. So there's there's a good bit of visual stuff that I can do that I think, to be honest with you, you know, I don't know where that stands in certain people. I've had some people in the visual field give me shit about. But to me, you know, there's muscles of the eyes. So I tell them, I'm just looking at the muscles of the eyes, man. Why is that any different than their hamstrings? You know, I have some visual tests, but when there's something that I, like there's a glaring thing or someone has an eye exam or if they have a just, you know, basic contrast issue or a basic clarity issue. Yeah. There, I have, I'm fortunate where I've made friends with an optometrist here who is deeply, as crazy as I am about this vision stuff and perception and working with athletics that I can refer people to, but I've learned enough, to check, be able to check certain things. And then I also have a synaptic visual tablet. So there's a company called Synaptic that they have a tablet, and then they have like this huge, huge touchscreen TV thing that they also offer their visual tests. And it does, and it's not, and I tell people this is not the place to go see an optometrist. Like, but I, if there's something that's glaring on those tests, I have, then I refer out, I punt. You know what I mean? I'm not trying to do anything, but there are certain tests that I think coaches can do very easily to get a sense of things. And if they don't know or don't feel comfortable to correct it, then sure, refer out. I highly implore people to have a good referral system.
Do you have any like tests or assessments that you could share?
Yeah, absolutely, dude. Sure, there's a whole bunch. So the first one I do is a binocularity test. So binocularity... it's several things. It's a convergence test, but it's also binocularity. There's two convergence tests I do. So we use what's called, if you Google it, it's going to be called a Brock string. Dr. Harrison always told me it was an eye tracking string. You know, I don't know whose vernacular you want to use, whatever, but a Brock string. So B-R-O-C string. If you look it up, it's just like a, I don't know, 6-8 foot string, depending, they come at different lengths and they usually have 5 beads on them. And you attach it to a doorknob or a squat rack or whatever, and you hold it to your nose, and then you space the beads out evenly. And what you have them do is you look at the beads, and the beads, let's just say the first bead, if you boys are doing it right now, is maybe 6 inches in front of their eyes. When looking at the bead, they should see one bead. They should see one bead, 2 strings going into it, and 2 strings going out the back. The reason why they see 2 is because when anything's close, we have 2 eyes. We're not cyclopses, so we have a nose between us that split things. So there should be vision coming out of, you know, you should be able to perceive and see things out of both eyes. What that coach on the call, the Division I basketball coach, when he held it to his nose, he saw 1 string and 1 line of string of beads. He did not see 2. So that means he's monocular. So he's only getting information out of 1 eye. Binocular means you're getting information out of both eyes. So the analogy I give, like the kids I work with, is you got camera 1, camera 2, those are your eyes, and your TV is your brain, right? And how, you know, I want to see how the cameras are working to give information to that brain, because the brain's going to want to see in HD. It's not going to want to see in, well, now, you know, it's going to want to see in 8K or whatever the frickin' TVs are now. It's not going to want to see in what we used to watch. You know what I mean? An old dusty TV. So if one eye is not perceiving or you know, clear as well, and this is not a clarity test, this is different, it's going to pay more attention to that 8K or 4K TV or camera. So that's what we're looking at. And so we go down, then you eventually go down the 5 beads, and there's more questions we ask to it than normally what you would find on the internet, which we can get into, but basically, the first thing you want to make sure is they see 1 bead and 2 strings going in, 2 strings going out of the bead that they're looking at. And then you go down the row of beads and make sure they can do that. Then there's other questions that you'll ask, is the X, right? There should be an X to a splitting of the beads. You know, is it in front of the bead? Is it in the middle? Is it behind? Is one string higher than the other? Is one string brighter than the other? That's going to give you good information about the strength or, you know, the clarity that the brain is taking from that eye. And that can give you a good amount of information. So going back, tying it back to my original story, that tennis player, his right eye was not nearly as strong as his left eye. So the majority of things he saw was bright and lower on his left eye and dimmer and higher on his right. Right. So that's where that perception gets skewed. So if that's the eye closest on the backhand, that's the eye that's going to generally perceive it closer and higher, you know, for his backhand. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And do you see that being a thing? I'm trying to think.
baseball. We look at like a... So that's high in baseball. So I generally in softball. Sorry, I don't forget about softball. I work with good softball players. So yeah, it's not a perfect science. Please, I'm really not trying to make correlational analysis and people come on me on social media and freaking chew me out. It's not a perfect science, but I've been able to work with athletes who, okay, I know let's just say they see the X, behind the beads the majority of times, right? And they see if they're a right-handed base hitter, they see their left eye's lower, right? So I'm willing to bet that I can say, I bet you struggle with fastballs. And if you do get a hold of it, you have a tendency to pop it up more. And more times than not, I'm right. Not always. I will not say I'm always right. And if that's the case, then we work on strategies to change that. Because I can't necessarily improve that. That's kind of what the brain wants. We can work on it, you know what I mean? But then we got to work on strategies and how to do that, how to get them to be better fastball hitters and how to square up on the ball better. Does that make sense? Because if they perceive, if their left eye is the one closest to the ball and they perceive it lower, they're going to have a tendency to hit it underneath the ball. Does that make sense? So yep. I want to square it up. So from a focus standpoint, we do drills now. We're focusing on the top of the ball.
Okay. Right?
Because that's going to square them back up.
Just compensating slightly.
Yeah. So now we do a whole bunch of drills with their focus, right? And we use the phrase aim small, miss small. We use the phrase aim small, miss small to focus on the top of the ball to then practice getting them squaring it up better.
Interesting. And then is that how is that then incorporated into your kind of training sessions when those guys come to see you? Is that just part of your kind of A series and things like that?
Yeah, it's all part of it. So my athletes come in, I generally see athletes for an hour. Depending on the day, if they're feeling really good, we'll do maybe more of the physical, little bit of the visual. If they're feeling like shit, we'll do more of the visual, little less of the physical. If they have, you know, I get athletes that play year round sports and they got competitions all the time. So like, they come in on a Thursday, Friday, I know they got a tournament of sorts on Saturday, then we'll do more of the visual stuff. Then I also give it to them for homework. You know, it's stuff they can do at home. A lot of the majority of things I have is things that we can take outside of the gym.
I like the sound of that. Is there any little kind of tips or snippets that you could give to any of the listeners to as like work on homework pieces you think would just be easy?
Well, first, check that out. You don't need a Brock string to do that. What Ryan used was just a rubber band, like a rubber cord, and he did it with his finger to that tennis player. If anyone, you guys got a shoestring, just use a shoestring and just put some pieces of tape and you should be good. So, I mean, a Brock strings are like $5 on Amazon or something, man. They're not a lot of money. But that is something that not a lot of optometrist tests will do. They generally concern themselves with contrast and clarity. So they don't look at that. Some do, some optometrists do. So I'm not going to say all, but majority don't. So that's definitely something worth doing. And not only is it a test, you can make it an exercise. So it has a dual effect. So you can do exercises with the Brock string as well.
And what do you do then if you go down that kind of contrast and clarity route as well? Or is that, do you just leave that to the other guys?
Generally, I leave that to the other guys. I can't improve that. Like clarity, okay, you got to go either get lenses or something is up. From a contrast standpoint, I can't improve that. But what I will do is work on getting you better, trying to work better on the vision that you have in low contrast. You know what I mean? So if I have people that struggle with low contrast, we'll do stuff in low contrast. So I had a baseball catcher, Division I baseball catcher, who he at night games, he could see the ball leave the pitcher's hand and then wouldn't see it again until it's about 5 feet in front of him. Like, that's kind of a fucking issue.
A little bit.
only night games, right? So I can't improve his contrast sensitivity. Now, there are, and I don't know, there's some, we can get into that a little bit. There's a supplement supposedly out there that's supposed to help strengthen the pigments of your eyes, to improve the blue light of your eyes that can improve contrast. I don't know. But what we did then was just a lot of vision training with low lighting. You know what I mean? I'd have him wear dark glasses or turn the lights off in the gym, and we're just working the shit out of getting the vision that he does have better with low contrast.
using things like the Brock string and stuff like that again.
The Brock string. Variants. I have all types of ball machines. I have some computer programs. We'll turn the contrast down really low on the computer. You know, and just work the shit out of it.
It's interesting that you talk about all this because I was at Florida State University in, God knows when would it be, 2011, 2012. And there was I worked at the football program then, and it was the head of strength and conditioning for the football program was a coach called Vic Valoria. I think he's currently at LSU, I think. And he said, I always remember this, we were talking, it was when Jameis Winston was there, and he obviously had the eye issues and stuff like that, which has been well talked about. And he was talking about, he had this like vision training machine and things in. And I was like, so what are you trying to do here? And he's like, well, I'm the strength coach. We train muscles. The eye's got muscles. Like it's my job.
Boom.
I was like, yeah. Boom. Like a light went off in my kind of head that day. I was like, shit, he's like 100% right. Like we need to kind of get smarter with this stuff.
Yeah. And again, you know, I think it's far more gray than it is black and white. You know, meaning optometrist, strength coach. Like, I think it's gray. Mm-hmm. Same with physical therapy, athletic training, all that shit. I think it's far more gray. There should be a blending and a communication, in my opinion, with that stuff. 100%. And, you know, you just, I don't know why it just came up in the top of my head. Another thing that I think is so easy to, it's fairly easy to check, but is not talked about it's not really talked about anywhere, but, you know, you mentioned football. Football is my passion. Football, working with wide receivers, guys that take their eyes off the ball, you know, going across the middle or whatever have you, you know, and this brings me up to that girl who saw double vision. This happens with her sister, who's a soccer player, is what Ryan and Dr. Bill Harrison call going consciously blind. So when you consciously think, one of two things usually happen with your eyes. One, you're going to lose control of your eyes. So if I give you guys some kind of really hard spelling question, like, you know, what I'll usually tell the kids is, you know, stare at my nose and spell Pittsburgh backwards. Well, all of a sudden they start looking around, their eyes are moving, or they stare in one direction. Or what happens, maybe what you guys might have just did was you kind of block out visually or mentally what you're looking at now, and you're trying to picture that word in your head. Like how many times you guys ever read a book, a couple pages into it, forgot everything the fuck you just read because you're thinking about the day, you're thinking about work, you're thinking about a pain in the ass client or your boss. You know what I mean?
Every day.
Yeah, you know what I mean? And that's what happens in sports a lot of times. So tying it to that girl, the basketball player's sister, we were doing some drills where I'm trying to get her to control her eyes where she's thinking. And I'd ask her a question. I think it was just like, spell your last name backwards. And she just – let me backtrack for a second. I have a ping pong ball machine that shoots ping pong balls. I have two color ping pong balls, an orange and a white. So what I have my athletes do, they're trying to work on looking the balls into their hands and identifying what ball to what hand. So for instance, orange ball will go to the right hand, white ball will go to the left. What I tell them is, I don't care if you catch it. I mean, that'd be nice, but I want to see you look it in. So I want to see them visually track it. So one, can you recognize? Two, can you visually track? And then three, I ask you questions. Can you stay focused on what you're doing while thinking? And I'd ask her a question and she'd stop. And all of a sudden, like five or six ping pong balls would just hit her in the head. And I'm like, okay, let's go again. And we would just keep doing this. And the same thing would keep happening. I was like, hon, is that, you know, does that ever happen where coach would yell at you or something on the field and you just kind of stop? And she said, yeah. and I have a lot of athletes, when they consciously think, they lose all sorts of control of their eyes. Right. So, you know, tying it into tennis, you know, I think that is a sport where it's paralysis by analysis. You know what I mean? I think a lot of the issues on the court sometimes are directed because they're overcoached and they're overthinking and they're not visual. You know what I mean? They're not in the moment. They're not just kind of focused more on the external. They're thinking, oh, I got to get my racket here, my wrist here, or my whatever, because maybe that's what they drilled the shit of, or my hand position, right? My hand's not over the right, whatever the stupid thing is that they're thinking about. And it's, you know, they make a mistake. So I was just out in California working with some NFL draft guys, and there was a top draft pick quarterback, I'm not going to say his name, throwing at this thing. And he was working with his quarterback coaches at the time, and they were trying to work on his mechanics of him using his lower body. And he couldn't quite get it. He was working on it. He couldn't quite get it. And when he was working on it, his passes were shit. They were throwing all over. He was hitting them in the ground. He was sailing over the receivers. And then he'd get pissed off and he'd bullet a pass, but it wasn't the mechanical way that his coaches were doing it. So, you know, you can't kind of serve two masters there. And when we're trying to, he's trying to think and feel and try to be accurate and fast at the same time. And it's like, you can't really do that. And he's trying to, you know, when we're consciously thinking, you're going to fuck up your eyes. His passes were sailing over. He was throwing him in the ground. He was getting really mad. And so, you know, that's such a simple thing that we'll do in our training that you guys can maybe do with your athletes is, you know, whatever it is, you know, whatever the drill is. I don't know. You're doing some kind of one touch, two touch drills, whatever the hell. Start asking them questions. So like wide receivers, you mentioned college football, love doing the jugs machine. Well, I would start asking them math questions, spelling questions, history questions, whatever. Get them thinking, right? Because usually, and I was a forward wide receiver going across the middle, usually they take their eyes off the ball because they're thinking about that hit that's coming, or they're thinking about the guy that's close. Do I plant my foot and go up the field, or do I continue on my path to try to get away? You know what I mean? They're thinking about things other than, you know, just being, you know, visually locked in on that ball. So learning to control your eyes while you're thinking is a huge thing that's not talked about, and it has high applicability to all sports.
No, that's great. And I think something as simple in tennis is even just like you're rallying cross court with your coach, training partner, whatever, and then somebody at the back, coach, another training partner, myself, just like you say, just asking simple math questions just so they've got to have something going on subconsciously and everything else.
Yeah, you know, the phrase mental toughness gets used a lot, and there's not a lot of definitions to it, and the one I give is, first, mental toughness, in my opinion, is context specific, but for me, in sports, my opinion, it's the ability to sustain focus on the task under stress. Can you stay focused on what you need to do while being stressed? And in tennis, for instance, or whatever, let's just say they're in a tight rally, they're going and stuff like that, they're fatigued, they've been playing for 3-4 hours, you're tired. Can you stay focused on visually, you know, locked in on what you need to do? And so, yeah, visual training is particularly awesome to do when an athlete's tired. So a lot of times that's something that Ryan does, I know, with a lot of the athletes he does out in California, was he'll do, you know, after they're working with their trainer, he'll have them come over and he'll start doing visual stuff with them. You know what I mean? To get them to work on staying focused and working on their visual system while they're fatigued. Because it's, you know, the fine motor skills or the fine muscles are the ones that usually fatigue first. And that's, you know, involving the eyes and the hands before, you know, all the bigger stuff fatigue. So yeah, doing stuff like that in the, you know, whether it's a rally or whatever you're doing with your tennis kids, I think will have huge payoff for you guys.
Is that another one of those situations though, where it's, you want them to be able to obviously perform the skill and do it in a controlled environment first, where they're not super fatigued, and then to make it more complex, open, et cetera, et cetera.
The cool thing about the vision training and this stuff is you can do it all the time. I would do it all. I would do both, right, to be honest with you. You can do it all the time. One, because it's not gonna drain their battery. It might drain their mental battery a little bit in the moment, but like, I've never had anyone come into me, you know, the day after doing that stuff and be like, man, I was so mentally tired and sore, you know, from all that vision training you had me do, or all that mental training you had me do. You know what I mean? So I think it would be good to do both, to be honest with you. Anytime you can get it in, that visual stuff, or the mental stuff, whatever you want to call it, I think that's just do it.
Yeah, and I like that as well, just because it's actually perfect timing, because one of our first CPD in my new position, the first CPD blocks we're going to do is actually behind mental toughness. And what you just said is kind of, I didn't use your definition or anything, but it's what I said with regards to everyone's got their own definition. So all tennis coaches, sports coaches have got their own kind of preconceived idea of what mental toughness is. And then it's about having a definition that we can all agree on, and then, so we can actually try and target an outcome as a result of that. Because if we've all got different definitions, then we're on a road to nowhere.
100%. And the majority of times, the kids that I asked, you know, have you ever heard of the phrase mental toughness? They said, yeah. I said, has your coach ever explained it to you? And they said, no. Like, for me, I think it's important. Like, if I'm going to use the phrase, you should understand what I mean. Yeah, so, you know, that's kind of my opinion of what it is. And then then my athletes understand why we're doing this stuff better or more, sorry.
So what would you think if we were to say, okay, well, little Jimmy can't hit his mark on the serve deep in the third set, serve percentage goes down to, first serve percentage goes down to like 15%. Obviously there it's multifactorial, but if they were like, oh, he's not mentally tough. He can't just hang in. And obviously a lot of coaches would potentially take a reductionist approach and be like, oh, it's purely the physical. He's not fit enough. Let's just say that's not the issue. Is there anything that you would kind of go to then, like little potential interventions or anything?
Yeah, I'd ask him, what's his visual process? What's your process? Like, what are you looking at? What's your process when you're going through your serve? Majority of people don't have a visual process. They might have a mental process, but they don't have a visual process. Where are you looking? You know what I mean? Where's your focus? From a visual standpoint, you know what I mean? Because they generally don't. So,
do you mean just we're setting up to serve? You're picking your spot. You're kind of looking back at your racket, reassessing your spot, know exactly what's going on, like almost like a checkbox list of what's going on.
Yeah, a checkbox list, exactly. So, sorry, I was trying to think. I mostly tied into with baseball. I can give you better analogies or stories with baseball, but with tennis, yes. What is your checkbox list of where you're looking, where you're focusing? And I would kind of go from there. So, like, I'll ask, again, American baseball and softball players that question. They usually don't know. They'll be like, I'm just looking at the pitcher. Okay. You know what I mean? But where? Are you looking at his leg, his hand, his foot? You know what I mean? His crotch? Like, where are you looking? You know, and I'm kind of watching his arm. You know what I mean? And, like, they don't really have a process. And I'll be like, okay, when you're at bat, you know, what's your task? What's the task when you're at the plate? And they say, oh, to hit the ball or hit it into play or advance the runner or something. I said, no, that's the goal. What's your task? And then they'll say the same things. Hit the ball, advance the runner, get on base, whatever. I said, no, that's the goal. The task should be whether or not to take the pitch. So first you have to identify what you want to do. That is the task. The goal then is to then identify the pitch, hit the ball, put it into play, advance the runner, whatever, blah, blah, blah. So again, and then how do we have this visual process of identifying the pitch, you know what I mean, first, and then we go through this kind of, I help them with a process of that. And that, a lot of that is based off of getting to know them, getting to know how they think, how they perceive things, having a soft focus than a hard focus. Soft meaning we're relying more on peripheral vision of kind of just looking at the pitcher. And then when they go through their windup, getting a hard focus right to the release points, or are they just looking at the release point the whole time, or you know what I mean, what it is they're going through. But I try to help them with a visual process. Maybe that kid just has a fucked up visual process. Maybe he doesn't have a visual process. Maybe he's just kind of like picking and choosing at the moment type of thing. You know what I mean? I would kind of go through that first before I go blaming. Yeah, it's easy to blame fitness. That's easy. Yeah, everyone blames fitness for the excuse. You know what I mean? Well, coach, maybe you should give them a visual process and some kind of understanding of, you know, what they should be looking for, what they should be doing first before you go blaming me, but whatever.
Would you put that more in the technical tactical box or tactical box?
I don't know, that can fall under, I think that's more of a gray thing. That could be under the visual side or the perceptual side of things, because that's also going to lead to their mechanical output and what they do type of thing as well. But nonetheless, I don't think a lot of athletes have a visual process in sports like tennis and golf and in baseball.
Yeah, I just want to add on to that, because from a personal experience, I've played tennis a little bit. I'm not the best in the world, but I like to give it a go. The biggest thing that always happens to me when I get tired is I'll stop looking at the ball when I need to, or I'll look at the like where it's going too soon. And then that, because your head's so massive, if you move your head at the wrong time, your whole body's going to move instead. So when I start my serve going, I'm like little Jimmy. My serve starts going when I'm tired. I stop looking up the whole time after I've hit it, and I'll like look away too early. So it's almost like the visual is important because it does dictate the movement. It's a bit like you were saying, how perception dictates your movement.
100%. And then 100%. And then tying it into what you just said with what I was getting at a little bit with the fine focus and the soft focus. So fine focus is your central vision, where you get the most detail and clarity. Your soft focus is your peripheral vision. Most athletes that I work with and assess, again, tying it into baseball, but this ties heavily into tennis as well, because I've done it with tennis athletes, say they see the ball when it hits their racket, when it hits their bat. Like, they say they can see the ball, you know, they watch it all the way in. and then I'll video them, and they'll look it in maybe, you know, I don't know, 10 feet to the racket, and then they rely on peripheral vision till it hits the bat or till it hits the racket. So technically they do see it, but it's peripheral vision. It's not central vision. And peripheral vision is great for awareness, but it's shitty for accuracy. You don't get a lot of detail. You don't get a lot of clarity out of your peripheral vision, but you get awareness. So getting them to be, you know, to rely or to train their ability to track a very fast moving object that relies, that's going to take a lot of depth perception, height perception, space perception, binocularity, all these visual tracking things, fixation abilities, speed and quickness of their eyes, near far quickness, blah, blah, blah. To be able to do that. But a lot of times they rely on their soft focus, and that's where you get a lot of errors as well. So maybe you mentioned it's what, his third serve, kid's tired, fatigued later on. Maybe he's relying too much on peripheral vision to hit his mark. Mm-hmm. You know, and that to me ties into that whole visual. He maybe just doesn't have a good visual process, or maybe doesn't have the visual abilities to get his eyes there or whatever. You know, it could be a lot of things, but that's kind of where my head goes with that.
Could you say that the eyes sense. Are fatigued by that point? Is that a thing?
Possibly. Yeah. I mean, fatigue is going to, affect the eyes usually first. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Or it could be fatigue, or just he doesn't, you know, have the checkbox, or he doesn't have the abilities to do that.
Mm-hmm. You know? Perfect. So I'm going to change the line slightly. I just want to talk about... I don't want to offend you here in any way, but I want to talk about like reaction lights or anything like that. Okay.
Yeah,
people talk about vision training, reaction lights. Do you mind just kind of explaining to people what you're getting from reaction lights? Are they useful? Are they not? That type of stuff.
Yeah. But
you're maybe not getting.
So for me, I look at, this is the strength coach in me. I look at the vision stuff, similar how I look at exercise selection on a spectrum of transfer of training, you know, so you got your general, you got your specific preparatory, specific developmental, then your specialized, you know, your competitive exercises. I look at vision training that way. So I see Brock Strings, I see those computer programs, the DynaVisions and all that stuff as very good general reaction to stimuluses. That's why they have studies that you know, those companies have studies showing that it does improve transfer, just like, you know, in my opinion, tying it into general weightlifting, that's why squatting can improve someone's speed on the pitch. But as you guys know, you know, the longer they've been squatting, or with some people, squats don't improve speed. So it works for some, but not for everybody, you know. But we know from a transfer of training standpoint on a spectral, that's more on the general side of things. So that's the way I look at that stuff. So it works for some, not for everybody. With generally the lower level athletes I work with, the 7, 8, 9, 10-year-olds, I think that stuff is great for them. You know what I mean? That's not to say I don't do more play-based reaction stuff, but from the visual side of things, you know, ability to react to a visual stimulus and get them to process that, I think is huge at ages like that, or post-concussion and stuff like that. Not always, you know, so kind of that constraints-led approach, ecological dynamical systems theory camp will knock the use of technology and stuff like that. And I get their knock of it, but from a training standpoint, I see it as general. I see it has a place for some people. And then sometimes there might be sometimes where it's just me one-on-one. I don't have 10 other people to set up some kind of game or some kind of environment that matches, you know, what they do on and for soccer or for basketball. So I can't do that, but I can set up maybe 10 lights that they now can react to. You know what I mean? That can give them something. So I find it better than nothing. It is expensive. So the problem with those companies, though, are they think that their company is the company and, you know, it solves cancer, not knowing the shortcomings of it. They're general, and they work on a lot of good visual processing skills, but it's general. So buyer beware type of thing. I have fit lights and I think they're fantastic. I don't use them with my higher level athletes. I use them with my lower level athletes, but from a visual processing standpoint, I think they're fantastic. And then when you tie it in together, the use of those lights with some other visual modalities, I think it's even better from a visual processing standpoint. And then we're talking about the consciously controlling of their eyes and stuff like that. I think that stuff's awesome, but I do think it's very general. you know, at some point you have to have that bridging of building things towards what they have to do on the pitch or on the ice or on the court or whatever sport you're working with. But general exercises, as you guys do know, can improve athletic performance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially in that youth population or the really kind of low end of that youth spectrum as well, I think. That's where it's got, for me, it's got the value, like you said, that kind of maybe 7 to 10 years. It's fun as well. And I think I was guilty of it earlier in my career where it's like, oh, I'm not in the entertainment business. And now I've gone like, well, I want them to enjoy what they're doing because if they enjoy it, they're going to come back. And if they come back, sure, then they get better, you know? So
absolutely. And again, you know, maybe it's, I don't know how the weather is for you guys where you are, but in Pittsburgh, the weather's pretty shitty all year round. You know, so oh, yeah, you can't always Rainy get outside. England. I can't always be... Yeah, dude. Well, Pittsburgh's not much better, man. It's the weather's not great and shit. So sometimes, you know, we got to do things inside and come up with stuff. And, you know, from an information processing standpoint, I think even though it's general, it's still good to improve their information processing or their visual processing skills. We still can work on the conscious controlling stuff. So there's still skills we can work on that will, I think, eventually transfer. So when we can get outside, we can now incorporate it into those kind of drills.
Mm-hmm. So I just want to, again, change, kind of get away a little bit from the vision stuff. Yeah. Cause I think we've covered quite a lot there as well. And I want to get into a little bit more to do with the maybe change direction. Obviously the vision's a huge part of that.
Yeah.
Do you mind talking about the kind of lenses that you view change direction through? And then how you go about implementing that. So I think you gave a great example. I think was it your CVAS presentation where you talked about you had a running back and you needed to improve his like 90 degree cut, for example.
Yeah. So generally, I mean, anyone listening to this goes on social media, you're going to see different schools of thought with change of direction. You'll have your mechanical side of people who are teaching closed drills. You'll have your strength side of people that, will do heavy isometrics and eccentrics and say that is all you need for, all you need for change of direction. Just get them fast and get them strong eccentrically and they'll be able to stop. And, you know what I mean? And then you got the other side of, hey, just put them in environments where they can self-organize and let them play and they'll figure it out. You know what I mean? So you kind of have these camps on there, and I don't think any one of them is wrong. Personally, for me, I'm in the strength and conditioning industry, especially, you know, I'm almost 40 years old. I just don't give a shit anymore. I'm a sit on the fence guy. I'm gonna sit on the fence. I think you need all of it. I think at the end of the day, spectrally, it's all of it. We need all of it. To what degree and for whom and for what, you know what I mean? That's where it varies. So for young kids, I'm not going to do heavy eccentrics and isometrics. I might do some isometrics, but not heavy eccentrics. You know what I mean? We'll work on the technique stuff, and then we'll let them play. We'll do a lot more play. You know what I mean? For the older kids, maybe it's more technical and eccentric stuff, and they're getting their play from all the competitions and training they do. You know what I mean? So mm-hmm. I think you need all of it. In my opinion, you know, my bullshit barometer that I use, anyone that says – you need just one thing is full of shit. You know what I mean? Anyone that's pushing just one way of doing things is just full of shit. You need all of it. It's just for who and for what. A lot of people don't give context for things. It depends on the context of who you're working with and what you're trying to achieve and what the outcome is.
Yeah, no, definitely. And then how do you kind of, with those things in mind then, what are you doing if you're trying to really break down movement? What's the first thing you're looking at?
Okay, so now getting into the biomechanics. So generally, I want to see how they change direction, whether it's watching game film, which I love watching game film. I was a sport coach originally, so that's at the heart of me. Not always do they have video, so then we'll do some stuff in my facility where I can kind of see how they change direction based off a reaction and just get a sense of that. The doctor, Michael Yeses and me, you know, I generally start with biomechanics first, so I want to see how they move. I want to see how well they stop, and then I want to see how well can they, you know, get out of that. How well can they get out of that stopping position? It's usually the stopping that most athletes that I work with struggle with. You know, for what I was taught in my view, I want my athletes to be as efficient as possible, but also as safe. So I want to see how few steps can they take to stop. I don't want to see pitter patters. I was never a wide receivers coach when I coached college football that taught pitter patter. I want you to be able to do it in one step. Can you go 100 miles an hour in this direction and in one step redirect in the other direction, as opposed to giving away what you're doing by pitter patter, breaking down, lowering, and then redirecting, you know, which now you've given away what you're trying to do and where you're trying to go, and the defense can react to it. So can you stop in one direction or in a direction in one step and redirect yourself? And how well can you do that? Generally, I know this is a little bit, I guess, maybe a little controversial or whatever. I don't want a lot of weight on the inside leg, you know, for many reasons from a valgus position. Someone, and I say controversial only because someone had this huge Twitter post that was sent to me. I fucking hate Twitter. That was sent to me on change of direction, how they teach having weight on their inside leg. That's not for me. Not to say that I can't have athletes when they change direction have weight on there, but that's not something I'm going to necessarily teach. You know what I mean? That I know goes against some of that self-organizing camp of thought, but what's funny about that camp is I did a post on Instagram about change of direction and showing pictures of these athletes, and they all have similar angles. You're right. I think here talks about the triangle. You know, I wish I thought of that before he posted that, because I mean, it's literally what I teach. It's just, I like that he uses a triangle. He keeps it very simple, making something very difficult, easy to understand in a simple word, a triangle to look for it. It's awesome. This ecological camp of thought posted their own pictures and stuff, talking about how it's all self-organizing and it's based off of, you know, the reaction to the environment. But the pictures that they used showed the fucking triangles and the same angles of the pictures I was showing. And I'm like, I mean, in my head, I'm just thinking, like, what are you guys looking at? Like, it's the same thing. Like, just look. So anyway, sorry, that's that quick little rant.
I like it on your soapbox.
But yeah, to be able to stop and start on one leg and redirect you in whatever that is. So for me, when I'm teaching, I want to teach them to be able to stop and start on one leg and redirect. And I want to do it in sharp angles. So we teach sharp angles first. The hardest cuts any athlete will make going 100 miles an hour, going their fastest, is going to be a sharp 90 degree angle and a sharp 180 degree angle. Those are the hardest cuts, right? And so we work on that. And I'm not saying we go at 100 miles an hour when we first teach it, but that's the angles we work on. And my athletes can attest, and what we've found is that, you know, once we've worked on the sharp angles, that makes every other angle very easy. It makes it cleaner. It makes it simpler. You know what I mean? Then we work on bends and we work on all that other stuff, running tight circles and all that stuff. You know, we work on the sharp angles first, but we do it with the big thing is trying to teach. So there's a lot of deceleration has been very popularized in our industry, teaching athletes to decelerate. I don't know, maybe it's just the simpleton in me, boys. I don't know. I haven't seen too many times in sports where my athletes decelerate and come to a complete stop. It's usually to decelerate and redirect in another direction at 100 miles an hour, not to decelerate to complete stop. And usually when they teach deceleration, it's on 2 feet. The majority of times that I've seen, it's on one fucking foot, because then you're going into another direction. So we do it in one direction. So from a technical standpoint, we teach one step cutting or stopping and then redirecting. And then we do that both from a technical standpoint. So if I'm using the movement camp, the closed drills type of thing, we do it from specialized exercise standpoint. So now we use exercises that not only are going to help strengthen the ability to do the cutting technique that we want, but are also going to help my athletes feel it. So they can feel their position. They can feel it. The sensory feedback will give them a lot of information of how to do that cut and how to get in and out of a cut much better. And then from a perceptual standpoint, we do it based off of a reaction. So it's usually based off of, first I start in steps. So I teach it like kind of, we're teaching a dance. So there's a 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2. We teach it in steps, and then we teach it based off a reaction to where I'm pointing. And then we teach it into multiple directions, but it's all based off of a reaction to a coach. And yes, it starts kind of general as far as pointing, but then we add in a step. We add in an open, you know, now the athlete's reacting to me where I step or where I open a hip or my body position. And then I add in a second person. So there was a great study done. I don't know who, I quote it in the that presentation composition cutting on the Strength Coach Network, where they're looking at changes. I think they were looking at knee angles and change of direction with soccer players. And they had this soccer, they had soccer athletes running at this big movie screen. And when they got to a certain point, the movie screen would point an arrow and the athletes would change directions. And they'd take the kinematic information from that. And then they had the athletes run at the screen and the arrow would point one direction. They had to react to another direction, the opposite direction. And then they'd have the athletes run at the screen and they'd show an athlete in one direction. The athletes had to react to another. And then they had two athletes and then three. Long story short, what the study found was the more specific the stimuli to their sport and the more visual people, the more people who are on the screen, the more their kinematics of their knee and their body positions changed. Right. So that just tells me from a closed standpoint, you have to build in the perceptual aspect to it. And that's, you know what I mean? So for me, that's how I try to tie in the three lenses, I guess, if in a nutshell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cause I take the approach of like phase one is almost our like technical development. So we've got a very close controlled environment, take it from isolated to integrated throughout the next few phases. Cause we've got to, if we can't do it, obviously in a closed environment with no external stressor, stimuli, whatever, then we're going to be so shit at it down the line. So I take it from technical development to general athletic development, looking on at combining different movement patterns, whether it be like shuffle cut, shuffle to like run step, whatever. And then the third step for me, the third phase is more of a sport specific environment, which is where we bring in the racket, the ball, the opponent and everything else. And we try to use what we've developed hopefully from phase one and phase two, that kind of amalgamated in phase three in that chaotic environment.
Yeah, that's awesome. You know, and again, that's different than what I see most of the closed people here do. Is a lot of times they work on the closed and then they go, okay, now go do that in an open environment. Here you go. Good luck type of thing. And it's like, no, you have to have an educated process of teaching that transfer, which you have. So yeah, that's great.
Yeah. I think it's just like everything else. There's got to be some sort of pathway and you can't just go from being able to crawl to being able to sprint. There's got to be a pathway.
Absolutely. And again, it keep butting heads with, I guess, and love your guys' opinion on it, the ecological standpoint, the viewpoints that there is no true cutting technique. There is no true mechanics. You know what I mean? The athletes are adaptable and they have to respond to the perception of their environment. Like, you know, I agree that there's not a true technique, but I believe that there are key movements and key aspects of technique that should be there. Now, the angles are all going to be different and the speeds and the velocities which you do are different because, you know, the environment changes and it's chaotic, but there should be some key aspects of the mechanics that should be there. And that to me is more the fundamentals of what I teach. So, you know, from a movement standpoint, we have the hard skills and soft skills. Hard skills, as you mentioned, the ideal mechanics in an ideal situation, because if it looks like shit there, it's going to look like shit in a blender. When you throw it into an environment,
I love that.
And so, in the hard skills, there are, and this is where the Dr. Yassas in me comes out, and he got this from his understanding of biomechanics, but he also got this from Dr. Verkashansky, who is a student of Nikolai Bernstein, who is the father of motor control and biomechanics. That there are, in every motor skill, there are key movements, and they're the force producing actions. And then there are secondary movements which help with the ability to control and coordinate everything else. But the key movements are the force producing actions, and this is what Verkashansky created his principal dynamic correspondence to meet the exercises that improve those key movements. And that was what his specialized special strength training manual for coaches discusses and gets into. And so for me, I'm looking at what are the key movements in whatever the motor skill we're improving. And for right now, we're talking about change of direction. And then I'm going to work on that. And those are the things I'm going to look for. And then as long as those are maintained, in my opinion, in a chaotic environment, then I'm happy. Everything else can fluctuate and change. And you know what I mean? And that's what I tried to also show in the video. That's an also knock I have on that side of the spectrum with those coaches who talk perception action, but they don't show videos to show the transfer. Like, okay, mm-hmm. I agree. I'm 100% agree. Now show me the videos of where it transfers.
Mm-hmm.
Show me the fucking transfer. We have to be able to quantify what we do, right? At least I believe we should. If more people did, maybe we wouldn't have such a big industry and there wouldn't be a rat race. But we should be able to quantify it. And that's what I tried to do in the video with that running back, was to quantify. This is what we saw in my first year working with him. He was not able to stop with one foot. He had to kind of gallop to stop. He was more of a kind of stopper, as opposed to just foot in the fucking ground, go. And we worked the shit out of it. We worked the strength out of it. We worked this exercise out of it. We worked the technical aspect out of it. We built in some perceptual stuff to it. And then, you know, I tried to show the video of him the next year and the year after, and it transferred. And, you know, it might not have been great, but at least I showed the evidence of what the fuck I tried to do. And that's what I think is missed in our industry. And I'm sorry for the swearing.
You'd have to apologize. I think that's awesome. And like you said, I know the presentation you're referring to, and it was nice to see that. Obviously you didn't show all of the exercises that you'd used, but you could see what you were getting at. And I could see that going back to what you were talking about earlier, I think there's fundamental biomechanical truths or principles that we've got to kind of work with. And then as long as you know the rules, then you can maybe start to break them a little bit or work around them. The problem comes when you don't really understand the rules, the biomechanical principles, and then you just start just throwing shit at a wall and see what sticks.
Pretty much, man.
Yeah. So I actually want to go into a little bit more, if you don't mind, just your specialized exercises, and say if we can use that one that was on the presentation that we're kind of referring to.
Yeah, sure.
What do you kind of think about? What goes through your mind when you're coming up with these exercises? Yeah, just
First and foremost, it's not me coming up with it. I'm not that smart. I rely on the minds of people much smarter than me to tell me what to do. I just take it and try to apply it to the context and the situation I'm in. So Dr. Yesus is the creator of those. I've always have and always will give him full credit to what I know. So Doc is the genius behind the specialized exercises. So if we're talking cutting, you know, we start with his side lunge. His side lunge should look like the end position of a cut. And so Doc's thing is, an athlete's generally going to get hurt for one of three reasons: poor mechanics, poor physical abilities in the mechanics, and lack of recovery, you know. And so we want to make sure we have adequate flexibility and strength in their mechanics. And so that's why Doc teaches the side lunge. So for me, any athlete I get day one, I'm teaching them how to do our front lunges and our side lunges. That's part of our warm-up. And then later on, it becomes our exercises. So I want to make sure they got adequate flexibility for that. So, you know, working with a lot of teenage boys, or the world where we've been in, where everyone's sitting, all that my athletes are sitting home, sitting in front of a computer, we're sitting all day, their hips become super tight. I want to make sure we got adequate range of motion in the ability to change direction for that. So we start with the lunge. We might add some weights if I want to strengthen it, or if I want to get them, if I want to get them some more flexibility and that. And then we have Dr. Yesus's active cords, which we use, and we put a belt around the waist, and now we're teaching how to push off. So to go a little step before we get into lunge and the specialized exercises, the preparatory exercises we do before play an important role for laying the foundation of the specialized exercises. You can't necessarily, you can to a certain degree, but mostly with young athletes, you can't just apply specialized exercises without the adequate preparation to it, right? There should be some prerequisite exercises you do before that. So we do a shit ton of hip abduction and adduction, knee flexion or hip flexion, hip extension before we do the lunges. Once we've kind of built a base of that, then we do the lunges with the cords off the wall. If you have a weight stack device, that's awesome. If you have I have a K pulley, which is amazing. A Kaiser, any of those things. The more variations you have, the better. The more years of progress you can also have using those exercises. So we'll teach the lunge. We'll do it for them, strengthening the ability to push the ground away. At that time, we might start doing more general lateral types of jumping exercises. You know, whether it's two-footed hops over mini hurdles or whatever, as long as it's general, but it's kind of covering that range of motion, that direction. And then we'll turn those lunges into explosive lunges. So now we'll go less resistance. Now we're trying to work on them jumping out with that resistance, but still landing into the side lunge. So still keeping the technical integrity of what we're trying to work on. And at that time now, we might start doing some single leg jumps, going from your right leg to your left leg as far as you can. We might be doing some different hops that we got from Natalia Berkoshansky, going over some bands and stuff like that. But we're starting to up the more of the lateral movements at that time. Usually also at that time, from a technical standpoint, we're well into teaching our 90 degree cuts and our 180 degree cuts. You know what I mean? So from a technical standpoint, our teaching technique matches the strength development that we're also doing. And then once we're kind of really into our SPP phase and stuff like that, we're doing more plyos, lateral plyos. So we might be doing that, for instance, that leg to leg jump, jumping from your right leg to your left leg, but now we're going for speed and for distance. We might be doing compass jumps. So let's just say you're on your right foot, you're trying to jump north, back, east, back, south, back, west, back, but trying to do it as fast and as far as you can. So those might be some good special strength exercise. And then the plyo or the side lunge, we might be doing in a plyometric fashion. So now we still have resistance, but it's more on the lighter side. We walk out a bit further, then we jump onto, let's just say, your left leg, and then we explosive lunge back into our right leg. So now it's more of a plyometric action of that. And then by that time in our teaching progression, we're in a multiple cut reactionary phase where we're doing more game like type stuff. Yeah, hope that makes sense.
Yeah, I think for the listeners that maybe haven't seen an example of this, I'm not sure if it's on your Instagram or anything.
I do believe I don't know what I got on Instagram. I do believe I have stuff on my Instagram. Yeah, I know I do. If you go in the explosive little story, I don't fucking know. Yeah, I know. That's probably hard for the listeners to understand what I'm trying to say.
I think the best way to describe it, I think a good way to describe it is it's not just a regular lunge.
It's not a regular lunge, no.
You're driving, I like to think you're leading almost with the kneecap. So the kneecap's got to be pointing in the direction of travel. Just like when we actually cut, you're trying to move that free leg that you talked about earlier. It's a repositioning. So you're moving in the right direction. So if you were to take the next step, biomechanically, you're in a sound position to reapply force.
Yeah, we're trying to move our hips. That's ultimately what we're trying to drive is the pelvis. We're trying to drive our pelvis by doing hip abduction. And then we're pointing our so if I'm doing that with my left leg, I'm hip abductioning with my left leg, driving my pelvis to the right. I'm opening up my right knee and foot in a 90 in a straight line, in the direction that I'm hip abductioning, or away from where I'm hip abductioning. And if that hopefully is a good visual.
That makes sense. Yeah, we can attach some videos or whatever.
Yeah, I'll send some over.
That'd be perfect. Yeah. Well, I know it's we're getting on for a little bit of time here, Jeff, but I just want to say thank you so much for coming on. This has been it's been a blast, man.
Boys, thank you. It's been my honor. I appreciate it. Always good to talk with people smarter than me. So I appreciate you guys. I appreciate your time and thanks for sharing a beer with me over the call.
Absolutely. Cheers, man.
Cheers, bro. Yeah, cheers, Jeff. And I just want to add on the back of that from my end, is there any young coaches can definitely take a lot from at least your mindset to things, Jeff? Like nothing should ever be in silos, one train of thought. It's absolutely loads of scales of gray. And I think you like a lot of the stuff that you talked about today and in presentations and articles from you is great about understanding that you just know when to use which hat and how heavy to wear the hat. Not only put some other bit of hats on, a little bit smaller, but really important to understand that.
Yeah, thanks, man. Yeah, the big thing, you know, I try to pass on to young coaches. There's no absolutes. Anyone who makes absolutes, you know, only Sith Lords make absolutes, right? Isn't that from Star Wars?
Love that.
You know, only Sith work in absolutes. Anyone who has secrets is full of shit. You know, just, I don't know. There's no secrets out there, man. Yeah. Feel free to reach out to coaches. Coaches are far more willing to help than you might think or might appear on social media. But yeah, there you go.
For sure. And is just for anyone that's maybe got any questions, social media, kind of email, anything
like
that?
Generally, really the only thing I use Twitter just more or less just to read what stupid people post. I like Instagram. I like seeing videos. I'm more of a visual preferred learner. Instagram's what I use more. You can message me on Instagram. Email me at jmoyer@dcsportstraining.com. I have a website, dcsportstraining.com. I have Facebook, which I really don't use. I don't know if anyone uses Facebook anymore. Yeah, that's about it.
Perfect. Well, once again, thank you for coming on. Thanks, really appreciate it. Hopefully we can get you on again sometime.
Yeah, man. Appreciate it. Thanks, boys.
Cheers.
Cheers, man.